army did not understand suicide. And it's getting better, but if I'm being critical, I would say I still don't think the army understands the illness that drives somebody to die by suicide. The program has reduced suicide by 2/3. That's not success. Success is stop everybody. We're not stopping until it stops. When the army lets go its trained soldiers to become civilians again, it needs to understand how better to interact with that. So success would look like soldiers demobbed without falling through the cracks.
Baz Melier had an extraordinary and spectacular 40-year career in the army. He ran a successful business in Dubai, but gave it all up to lead a counter-suicide program tackling the devastating issue of veteran suicides. The work he and his team are doing is tough, vital, and deeply needed. A warning that we therefore talk about suicide throughout this conversation, which some may find distressing. Please listen with care and don't hesitate to skip this one if it's unhelpful or upsetting. We've listed a range of support resources in the show notes and on our website, should you need them. There is also some laughter, at times dark, but Baz's energy, passion, and humour are unmistakable. His unfiltered Scouse directness, it's exactly what's needed to drive this bold, purposeful work forward to stop veteran suicide. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Baz.
I spent just shy of 40 years in the army, joined as a rifleman. I was encouraged to join by Merseyside Police Force. It was back in the day when they, you know, they were very good at community policing. And they turned up at my place and said, look, you know, you are heading for trouble. So here's the best route out for you. And I never looked back because I found a new home, which allowed me to ascend through the ranks of a family, which is the army. And I thought I'd do 2-3 years, but I ended up doing just shy of 40. And I finished off as a Lieutenant Colonel in the Rifles. Having had a short spell running my own business in Dubai, like so many other people, returned back to the UK during COVID and was contacted by regimental headquarters because there was a wicked problem starting to bubble within the veteran community and the serving community, which was mental health, and right at the back end of that was a growing number of suicides. So now I work for the regimental headquarters of the Rifles, not as a civil servant, but as a project officer running a program called the Always a Rifleman program, which is a mental health well-being program, but it has a unique element, which is a counter-suicide program specifically designed to stop suicides in the veteran space.
The first thing I want to comment on is the remarkable achievement of you and people like you to have made it from private to lieutenant colonel. Richard Newgee, who was on this podcast not that long ago, talked about how someone who reaches lieutenant colonel, having started as a private soldier, has been promoted more times than the chief of the defence staff is promoted. So it's an enormous accolade, and you're in a rare group of people.
Even more if you get reduced in rank a couple of times.
Oh, so you so it took you longer to get there. And of course, what we really are here today to talk about is a difficult subject, but is often not talked about. It's obvious that we're going to talk about difficult matters here that are going to affect some of our listeners. So first up, I think if you're hearing stuff here that you find difficult and you're struggling with, press pause, come back when you're either feeling better, or go to our website and you can find good support locations where you can seek help and advice. All of us will have been either right at the centre of a suicide or connected somehow to it. Can you talk about your first encounter with suicide?
We were in Northern Ireland on a 2-year tour in Omagh, and it was right in the middle of options for change. So we'd lost our identity. We were originally the 2nd Battalion, now we were the 1st. A lot of my mates were made redundant, so the guys were posted out, new faces were posted in. Everything from the pictures to the signs had changed. It was a really turbulent time. I didn't feel like the same chap I was. And right in the middle of it, a guy I'd been good friends with for 10 years, you know, we'd played football together, lots of it. We'd party together many times. We'd chase girls together, you know, as single young men. We had a great history. And right in the middle of the options for change, he died by suicide. I was aware of my platoon sergeant's battle course at the time. I remember asking the director and staff, could I have this day off, please? A good friend of mine has died. And the director and staff said to me, no. I stunned. No, what do you mean, no? And I'm a scouter, I'm militant. So I went, you don't mean no, what do you mean? And he said, no, your friend has died of suicide and that's very selfish of him, so we're not letting you have any time off. Now you just got to, for a moment, picture me, you know, at age 26-ish, maybe 27. I was really conflicted by that phrase. I was conflicted that somebody said that's selfish. Fast forward 3-4 years, and I'd been off to Mozambique to do some training with the Renamo and Frelimo people. The battalion had moved to Cyprus, and I returned to the battalion fold. And the very first thing somebody said to me was, hey, Jill, my friend's wife, and Chloe, my friend's daughter, are down at the beach. And I thought, I've got to go and firstly say hello and then also explain and apologise for my absence at the funeral. And I rushed down to the beach. And I was expecting almost to see this lady in black, you know, grieving. And she is a beautiful woman. Big smile on her face when she saw me, big hug. And her daughter, Chloe, you know, emerald piercing eyes, you know, just an absolutely gorgeous child. And I thought, wow, you know, they seem so resilient. They seem to be dealing with this really well. And then the penny dropped for me. Nobody in their right mind would leave that behind. When my friend took his life through suicide, he didn't do that because he was of sound mind. It wasn't a choice, it was an illness. And I think at that very moment in time, I realised that the army did not understand suicide. And it's getting better, but if I'm being critical, I would say I still don't think the army understands the illness that drives somebody to die by suicide.
Part of the challenges your friend felt and confronted, I suspect, was about belonging and what had changed. But one of the things that I see a lot is male loneliness, the inability for men to feel that they can communicate honestly and openly about their feelings. Is that something that you've seen as well?
It's all that on steroids. So I've been very fortunate to strike a relationship up with some leading experts in suicide. And James's Place, which is a male-only charity, predominantly focuses on students and university in London, Liverpool and Newcastle. King's College London, Professor Edgar Jones, who's a ninja in understanding veteran space. And they are experts in their space, but when I glue them all together, you get what I do. So James's Place explained to me about that belongingness and then referred to a study done by Cambridge called Thwarted Belongingness, which is now an NHS definition of what you describe. It's where you find a belongingness that you're so wedded to and the love for it is so strong that when you're removed from it, it's cataclysmic. It's absolutely life-changing. And when things change in our environment, we either become thwarted or we become discombobulated, and that leads to loneliness. Take myself, for example, where I came from a dysfunctional background in Liverpool and didn't per se have a family life. And my family was young boys just like me, stealing lead from church roofs, etc. It was a gang, for want of a better expression. It was a gang. Had the police not interdicted in this gang, picked out a couple of people and said, you know, you should do this, I definitely would have ended up in jail. That's a guaranteed end state. What I didn't realise was when I joined the army, I joined a family. And that family, it masked over all of my ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And I think by the time I was 12, I had more ACEs than a Vegas croupier. I'd done everything wrong. But needless to say, they're masked over, they're hidden behind integrity, honesty, loyalty, commitment, dedication, selflessness, all them things that the military gives you. And then you go and practice, and it's reinforced by very good leadership, which means it's now on steroids. And when it's taken away from you, it can be final. And for a lot of people, it is.
And that remarkable example that you've given about bad gangs and being part of a good gang is something that I've seen a lot as well. And one of the things I think that the military does, and the army would say that they do it particularly well, is finding and creating esprit de corps and fighting spirit through that process of belonging. As we all have to leave the army at some time or hang up our uniform, so that transition and change happens, how well do you think we are at enabling that transition to happen so that we still feel that we belong beyond the uniform?
Transition is something that the military doesn't understand. And I frequently say this, we've got it wrong. When you join the army, you're brought into the army by civilians. When you're leaving the army to become a civilian, you're taken out by the army. You know, it's an army-run project. It makes no sense. It should be the other way around. The people who should be receiving me into the civilian street should be civilians. They should be guiding me. And the people who bring me into the army should be the army. One of the things that transition doesn't do is it doesn't decondition you. Your mind is conditioned to be selfless, to be committed, to be risk aware, to tackle risk, to be brave, not to let standards slip. Consequently, when I see somebody parking a disabled bay, I'm getting out my car to challenge him. If I see a dog walking up, pick up after his dog, I'm going to chase him. And, you know, my son has chased me down a road to say, what are you doing, Dad? And I've gone, he's jumped the queue. I got myself into a really sticky position on a train just recently. There was a couple of boys vaping and being loudmouthed and very rude, and I couldn't accept it. And I stood up and I went over to these four boys and I said, chaps, it's a full train. There's some children and people who don't enjoy this language. Why don't you take it elsewhere? And one of them squared up to me. And then I thought, everybody in the train's going to stand up with me now. And we're gonna sort these boys out. And I looked around and it was just me. And I thought, wow, there's got to be 60 people on this carriage. Why is it just me? Now, Professor Edgar Jones will tell you it's just me because the amount of veterans in the community is so small that I probably was the only veteran. So I'm probably the only person who won't accept and tolerate that sort of behaviour. But I'm conditioned. Of course, when I leave the army, I'm not deconditioned. So my mind is still operating at the stage where I want everybody to be committed and loyal and dedicated. It's not my hands that need training. It's my mind that needs to be deconditioned.
In the work that you're doing now, you're focusing on the mind, of course, and also trying to intervene to prevent people from taking their own lives. I'm sure you don't have a normal day, an average day, but can you explain what it is that you do?
The whole concept is to stop suicide from happening. And we use some very clever techniques. Half of them are military, the other half are police tactics. I tried every way plausible in the first couple of months to stop suicide. And in week 3, week 4 of me doing this, there was a suicide. And I've gone, oh, my military estimate, my combat appreciation has failed. Where did it fail? Well, it failed because it's not a military problem. It is a wicked problem. So I went back and revisited how I was doing it. And I came up with two strategies. One, to use a police problem solving model called SARA, Scan, Analyze, Respond, Assess. And the other one is a theory called Broken Windows. Now, they both belong to crime and they both belong to police, but the broken windows is the analogy. If you see one broken window and you don't fix it, people will treat the rest of the street the same way. If you narrow that down to one person, if you have one broken window in your personality, if you don't treat it, the rest will get broken. So if you see somebody over drinking, that's a broken window. Why is he over drinking? If you see somebody using drugs, why is he using drugs? If you see somebody erratic and screaming and shouting or is discombobulated, it's a broken window. It's telling you something's going wrong. What we needed to do was produce a whole heap of people who could tell me that's what they'd seen. So the program put together a training program where we travel around the country and we train people to look for something. When they identify it, they drop it into an emergency channel, which is managed by 10 riflemen, all of whom have been through the challenges of thwarted belongingness or attempted suicide. They know intimately what it takes to be in a position where you're contemplating ending your life. The scanners scan, we analyse, and we do something about it immediately. When I say immediately, we try to get within their space within an hour of that notice that somebody is considering or behaving in a way that looks like he's in a crisis, on the edge of crisis, or is about to take his own life. We use volunteers to do it, and right behind that volunteer who gets in the mix to try and talk to somebody and just say, remember me, I was in your platoon, I was in your section, that's then followed by the expert, a couple of doctors, if we need the police, if we need the ambulance service. So there are no 2 days that are similar. The boys on the program work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They carry emergency phones, which are all specifically designed to only answer that emergency call. Some of them are fixed in their workplace. It's either myself or another chap who works with me who gets in a car and drives to a crisis. And that crisis can be anything from somebody in the middle of committing suicide, and we've had plenty of them, or somebody who's been identified nice and early as he is definitely in crisis. So it's the whole range between on the edge of the platform, doing CPR on somebody, to identifying somebody who we know is going to go into a crisis and we interdict his journey before it gets too severe.
There's an easy and lazy stereotype of veterans as either mad, bad, or sad. I wondered what you would say to those that still ascribe that to veterans.
There is a lot of very ill-educated theories about servicemen, and there's a lot of ill-educated theories about PTSD. And some of the veterans don't understand what PTSD is themselves. When you meet somebody with PTSD, and particularly the most vicious form is the moral injury, the inability to communicate with clarity, the inability to interact with people socially, the inability to digest the beauty of a landscape or a conversation with somebody or a coffee with somebody. It's horrendous. I've spent a lifetime of trying to explain to people what PTSD really looks like. And when you bump into it the first time, as I did, it's probably shocking. When you hear somebody who describes every footstep that he takes as a jab in the eye of fear that this is the last step he's going to take. If you imagine every time your heart beats, somebody's punched you in the back of the head, your mind becomes numb and you find it hard to articulate. And then there are boys who genuinely suffer with video replays. They will get quite upset quite quickly. We went out to Normandy. We drove into the ferry. And when you're in that ferry, it's very condensed. It's packed with cars. And we were walking out of our car, heading towards the exit, and somebody's car alarm went off. The noise reverberated around the tin of the vehicles and the ship, and it sounded like a mortar alarm. And one of the boys who was with us exploded with fear. So that is your stereotypical scream and shout. He covered his ears and he screamed at the top of his voice, "I've got to get off, I've got to get off." We're at sea, there is no getting off.
And is there a strong correlation to operational experience? Or is that the cumulative effect? I remember a brilliant military psychiatrist describing the cumulative effect of life events. You talked about adverse childhood experiences. Yeah. The chap had lost a great mate on operations in Northern Ireland, and then his marriage fell apart, and then his dog died, and it was the dog dying that was the catalyst for him too, and he described it as losing his marbles. Is that what you're seeing as well?
It's exactly that. It is an accumulation. I talk about change. So your girlfriend dumps you. You know, as a young lad, I was dumped a lot, so I was quite conditioned to it by the time I joined the army. That change, for some people, is catastrophic. For some people, they'd be able to ride it out. With a layered complexity, so lots of adverse childhood experiences, lots of military trauma, and then you hit a thing called a double dip. So the double dip is where you naturally fall into the space where mum and dad are very poorly. Maybe your wife's had enough of you. So it's mum and dad or at death's door. Wife's fed up with you. Your daughter, who's this role model you think is going to become a doctor, comes home with a punk rocker with no ambitions in life and just wants to smoke weed. And all of a sudden, you're in this dip where you're thinking, why did I work so hard? Why is everything turning in on me? So that double dip is that complexity of layered trauma just come to fruition. And Manchester University do a great study which allows me to profile who I go looking for. So typically over a weekend we get 5-6 calls. Sometimes they go bam, bam, bam. You know, around about 12 o'clock at night we'll get a couple of calls. Mm. And we'll need to triage because ultimately there's only 10 of us. And only 3 or 4 of us can move without using the police or the ambulance. And sometimes the police or the ambulance can't get there. So you have to triage them, and we profile them. And we look at the Manchester University report that says, you're looking for a man under the age of 25 who did a short engagement and has been out for less than 2 years. There's profile one. Profile two is the double dip guy. The guy who's at the end of his career, he's about 43, 44, and he drops into a natural space where midlife crisis, mum and dad poorly, children now fighting him, and he thinks, this is it, I can't go any further. But on top of that could be a cancer diagnosis, you know, a dementia diagnosis, and then got to find money for a mortgage. Yeah. I've got to find a job. I've got to find a boss who understands me and has the same level of commitment and dedication as I do. Mm. And they're real challenges. So they're the two people we bump into the most, young guy, and then exactly the far end of the spectrum, the full career, the guy who's now facing life challenges as well as combat, as well as the ACEs.
In your work that you do the early detection and identify those moving into crisis, can you talk about the human terrain analysis element?
The most important thing in identifying somebody who is close to a crisis is conducting a human terrain analysis on the individual. We do that by identifying his broken windows. Most of them come from domestic life. Then we analyse his professional life and we look at the exposure to combat. Then we look at all the people he's connected to see who else has been involved in combat and how fierce that combat was, how kinetic it was. And when we look at his personal life, his professional life, and then we look at his previous life, we drop it into the emergency channel that looks at all components of his life, looks at the components of his friend's life, and we press a little button on our special app. And it gives us an instant picture of how much trauma that person has suffered. Once we've got that picture of an individual in his human terrain, we can analyse whether he's really close to a crisis or he's on the verge of crisis or he's actually right smack in the middle and we need to do something in the next couple of minutes.
What you're describing is a relentless requirement to commit to this work. What would you say success looks like?
The programme has reduced suicide by two-thirds. And at a conference just recently, academics, doctors, they all stood up and applauded that. That's not success. Success is stop. Everybody, we're not stopping until it stops. We've got to find the right formula, and the formula is a societal issue. It's not the program's issue. We're acutely aware that all we are doing is treading water until somebody comes up with a better solution than we have, which may look like a better transition. It may look like a better hospital treatment. King Charles II built the Royal Hospital Chelsea because he knew servicemen were struggling with identity when they came back from conflicts in East Asia. Whilst we think we understand it now, I'm not certain we do, because it's a changed civilian environment, it's a changed country, it has a changed identity, and when the army lets go its trained soldiers to become civilians again, it needs to understand how better to interact with that. So success would look like soldiers demobbed into civilian street without falling through the cracks.
Have you always got it right when talking about this?
There's definitely a period of time where I needed to learn the language, learn the cues and indications and the body language and behaviour of people. But I think people misunderstood what I was doing for a living and what mental health and stopping suicide looked like. And I guess they weren't ready for what I say. So we have had a car crash. We've had a couple of car crashes when words have come out of my mouth people just weren't ready for. Some of it is definitely my fault, because I didn't flag up or warn people. I was about to talk about things which are very sensitive and personal and private. And also some people in the room probably didn't realise the depth of knowledge and experience and the lengths, the extreme lengths we go to stop suicide, and what it looks like when we stop suicide, because it's not pleasant. Mm-hmm. Right at the beginning of the journey, we had a meeting where somebody invited me to come along and talk about what the programme does. And as I started talking about this programme, there was a young lady in the room. I could tell she was struggling with some of the words I was using. And she was recognising what I was saying was exactly what she just witnessed, because she just lost her son, who died through suicide. As I could see her starting to well up, I asked if she was all right. And she absolutely mullered me for good reasons. And she burst into tears. Ultimately, I talked about how me and the team were working really hard to stop suicide and prevent it from happening. And that didn't happen for her son. So she absolutely pummeled me, and rightly so. The pair of us were in tears. The rest of the committee were welling up, and a couple of other people were in tears. And I guess I learned the very first lesson in talking about what I do, to issue people with a warning and say, listen, this is very, very damaging to you if you've already been damaged by suicide. Everywhere I go now, I issue a warning and say to people in my space, guard your language, because I want you to know that somebody who I'm stood with will have been affected, will be a casualty of suicide. Every single day, I am with somebody who is a casualty of suicide. So when I answer the phone, I just tell people who I'm stood with. When I'm in the car, the very first words out of my mouth are, you're free to talk or you're not free to talk. Because that one moment was quite defining for me. It hurt. It really hurt. It hurt me, because I would never intentionally hurt anybody with my words. And on that occasion, I did.
As the work that you're doing is informed by your knowledge and understanding, and also by your passion and commitment, and you're doing as much as you possibly can, what would you do if you had a blank check?
Do you know, we talked about belongingness and connectedness being the conduit to what we do, to keeping people alive. It's presenting the opportunity for me to look somebody in the eye and go, are you okay? And if he's not okay, the opportunity for him to say to me, no, I'm not okay. And then I can do something about him. The guys who we've not saved are those who people say to me, we didn't see it coming. So I need to see it coming. And that was the broken windows theology. So what would I do if I had a blank check? I would build a new army, almost a home guard. I've had some great conversations with an anthropologist in America who was studying suicides in the Five Eyes countries. And we stumbled on the fact that the home guard is probably the best way of gathering people together, giving them a focus, giving them an identity, giving them a mission, giving them a purpose to belong. So with a blank check, I'd probably invite the Queen or Princess Kate to form an army of veterans. And that army would be a home guard in its various disguises. And twice a year, they would gather for 2 days training, make sure the boots fit. They would make sure that they could still walk and they could talk, and they were getting the proper medical care and they were getting the right social care. You know, there's a lot of talented soldiers out there who've got lots of energy. They're just looking for good leadership. That's what they need. They need good guidance, they need good leadership. I'd build myself an army that would look a little like Dad's army, but it'd be a home guard with a real capability.
I spent many years doing rear operations and doing 2.5 years of repatriations and looking after those that were damaged and injured whilst on operations and not on operations. And I felt the weight of the emotional burden whilst doing that. You've been immersed with this kind of work for quite some time. Can I ask how it is that you manage that trauma?
I am on a daily basis subjected to high levels of trauma. And they come sometimes in waves. They involve tears, they involve anger, they involve every emotion. I suppose to answer the question, I would have to go back to Cyprus and talk about Jill and Chloe. And when I parted that day from Cyprus, I looked at Jill and I thought she's going to be all right. And I looked at Chloe and I really feared for Chloe growing up without a dad. And I didn't see them for another 30 years. But when I started this job, I went looking for somebody who could give me a reference to how do I deal with this? How do I cope with suicide? And I went back to see Jill, who'd stopped being a regular nurse and become a therapist. And had dedicated her life to helping young people and adults with suicidal ideation. And I said to her, Jill, I'd really like your hand. She said, well, Baz, I will give you a hand. Under one condition, which is you take supervision and we treat you whilst you're treating everybody else. And I said, yeah, okay, but not you. And she said, no, I'll get Dr. Chloe to do it. And I went, who's Dr. Chloe? Chloe's a doctor. and I was like, wow, how did that happen? How she changed such a huge, monumental catastrophe in her life into something positive. To this day, I'm amazed. So to answer the question, how do I cope? I'm supervised by this amazing doctor who intimately understands the problem of suicide, who can identify all the problems I deal with, articulate them in a way that I understand them with my little scout's brain, can supervise me to make sure I don't overstretch, can mentor and manage some of the boys who helped me do it. And she genuinely is one of those people who can just be in your presence and inspire you, along with her mother.
God, my word, that's such a powerful story. I'm struggling to get my words out. Are there lots of Chloes, Dr. Chloes, for others?
Every therapist within the Always Rifleman programme is born to, widowed to, daughter of a rifleman. It's a fire hose of treatment because they speak the same language. But most importantly, they're invested in the family. Their energy and their commitment goes way beyond anything you'd get in the NHS. And what's more, is they start the journey from the intervention right through to the recovery and then the recovery wrap, which is where we wrap everybody around somebody to make sure he doesn't regress and he doesn't fall back. And when he does, because he will do, we've got them again and we can put them back into therapy if we have to. That invested families, as we term it, is the catalyst to success. And it's why at times the NHS is not successful. It doesn't have a recovery wrap. It doesn't have the ability to build a like-minded person around like-minded people. There is always a danger. The 10 boys I work with are remarkable. They're all riflemen. They tell me off when they know I've done too much because they see it, because they deal with the same thing, just in isolation. So one boy will deal with that, one boy will deal with that. I'm dealing with all of them. But when they see it, they do. They ring me up and say, you must take a break. And I suppose the other thing is that the Board of Trustees, they're taking an enormous risk in doing this. You know, we've had guys that we've done CPR on. The chances of them dying are real. They know that. There's just as much chance of somebody taking their own lives whilst he's on the programme. And that's a real risk because the family could accuse the programme of being the cause of it. It takes a lot of courage to accept that risk and agree to support it. I think we've done 68 interventions. I put my hand on my heart and I tell you this, there are definitely 20 people walking this planet who wouldn't have been walking had this programme not been stepped up by the Board of Trustees 3 years ago. And it wouldn't be working if the 10 courageous young riflemen who helped me deliver this weren't prepared to carry on that selflessness, that commitment to fellow riflemen, and genuinely, wholeheartedly believe in that family approach to soldiering. I know I've got to finish this at some stage. There is an end state. There is a strategy to build a bigger family in which people can morph into. And we are working on that. I would like to do myself out of a job in the next 2 years.
Well, good luck with your succession planning. I wonder whether your wife is a factor in that timeline as well.
I am blessed because my wife has genuinely rolled with the punches. I spend a lot of time in theatres of war, come home and she's morphed to my routine, which is bizarre because it should be the other way around. And every challenge we've faced it together as a family. One beautiful thing about my wife, when I was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, she sent me a letter, as we've always done, which had L/CPL on it. Because she really doesn't care about the army, but she loves the people in it. And it's that consistency in your life that has allowed me to be passionate about virtually everything I've done. I am incredibly fortunate. You know, when people ask me my luckiest moment in life, a number of times I came close to death in Iraq, and people say, oh, you were lucky there, and you were lucky there, and you were lucky there. And I buried six of my force protection in Iraq. You know, it really hurt. Actually, I'm lucky I'm married to this woman because, you know, without that, there definitely is no programme. When I chose to do the programme, and I did, I had my own business in Dubai and it was incredibly lucrative. And I stopped doing it to do this. And she didn't bat an eyelid, even with no windows in the house because I was refurbishing it. And now no money to do it because that stopped with my business. She didn't bat an eyelid.
What's your wife's name?
Jane.
Jane. To Jane. Selfless commitment is a core army value. But it's clear that Baz's wife, Jane, has it in spades too. Many of us know the quiet strength of our loved ones, and I know there will be silent nods of recognition out there. As I said at the start of this episode, this conversation might be a tough listen. So if you've been affected, a reminder that we've included some resources in the show notes and on our website. But I also encourage you, if you can, to please talk to someone you trust. You're not alone. Baz's resilience, drive, and humour shine through, but so does his belief in the power of the team behind him. There's a lot to reflect on here. It left me asking, what more can we do, together and as individuals, to face this complex challenge? If you'd like to share your thoughts, I'd love to hear from you. You can email the show at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.